Dr. John Goodenough.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the Layman's Leadership Institute for this opportunity to come and share these few days with you all. I live about 60 miles north of Boston, a little state of New Hampshire, and we've had a great deal of snow this winter, so much so that I've forgotten just how glorious the summer sun can be. But I'd like to say that the glory of the summer sun is nothing compared to the encouragement and support which I've received here from the warmth and from the overflowing Christian love which each of you have brought to this conference. Have you ever asked yourself why the world has become so science-minded? Why does modern man look increasingly to science while organized religion is pushed steadily to the periphery of his concern? The answer, of course, is obvious. We see the continuous parade of miracles that science is performing, and we, like others before us, are impressed by the miracle workers. But science attracts us on a more profound level, too. The sciences have been building a great structure of human knowledge, and this building is an elegant tribute to the mind and to the spirit of man. Paul describes two types of minds. The Jews, he said, require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. And both the men of action, who look for the signs of power, and the men of thought, who look for pattern and form, both have become fascinated with science. The princes of this world look to the scientists to provide them with military power, with a means for controlling the minds and the allegiance of their subjects, with the ability to rule successfully the great masses of the world who are now awake to the possibilities of a new dimension of freedom. For the primitive masses have also seen the miracles, and they demand bread for their bodies and a new dignity for their souls. They look to science to break their bondage to grinding poverty and to disease. No longer will they accept exploitation of man by man. For now they know that the energy that is required to sustain a complex society need no longer be extracted from animal power and from human slavery. It is available in the coal and the oil in the ground, in the atom, in the rays of the sun and the tides of the sea. Available because it can be converted into electricity, into motor power, into heat. Granted that the miracles of science and the beauty of its conceptions have captured the attention of men's minds, has the work of science undermined in a more profound way the once dominant position of religion? I believe that it has, wherever religion is satisfied to hold out to man the comfort and security of a static set of answers to all our questions about life, and wherever its chief concern is to provide a set of rules by which to regulate our living. Where religious faith consists only of an intellectual belief in a set of doctrines or teachings, science soon exposes error. Where religious faith is conceived of as a leap from insufficient evidence into the security of a closed system to the security of mental and social conformity, The scientific attitude challenges us to dare to question. For by questioning and testing, we prove that which is true. We overthrow that which is false. And this challenge to the church is healthy, for it is a mighty flood that shakes the very foundations, and whatsoever house is built upon the sand must perish, but whatsoever house is built upon a rock will stand. The challenge of science is an opportunity for true religion. For it is not the challenge of evil, but the relentless quest for truth that dares to question its most cherished notions in order to ensure that they are rock and not sand. It is important to distinguish between the questioning of a scientist. This is the legitimate and necessary questioning of every inquiring mind, and the questioning of the skeptic or cynic. The skeptic or cynic has been disillusioned, has experienced the shattering of an idol to which he once looked for security, and he is no longer capable of faith. The scientist, like the Christian, dares to question precisely because he has a deep, abiding faith. He questions in order to build, whereas the cynic questions in order to destroy. The scientist, like the Christian, questions that his house may be built on God's rock and not on the sand of some false idol. What then are the characteristics of Christian faith? Of scientific faith. There are two sides to this faith. There is the call and the response. The call is an inner voice. It is an inner vision. Now there are many voices that speak to a man's soul. There are the clamoring voices of the self-life, the whimper of fear, the trumpets of prejudice, the whisper of pride, the shout of lust, the command of ambition. And there are the varied voices from outside. There are the threats of the powerful, the bribing promises of privilege, the chance of security. How many are the voices that drown out the still, small voice of God? Yet creative faith cannot be born without the discernment in your soul of the voice of God. Now, the voice of God has an unmistakable quality. Even if we do not dare to believe that it is of God, the secret recesses of our being affirm its origin. Since the dawn of recorded history, man has been witnessing to a divine voice that speaks to him. Therefore, search not for the voice of God to speak to you out of lightning and thunder. The spectacle, the novelty, is never his mouth. He speaks in the stillness of a quiet soul. That declares him. That is his mouth, which fulfills his promises of old. Jesus has been criticized because he brought no new doctrine. But his uniqueness lies not in his teaching, but in the fact that he fulfills the old. That he fulfills the law and the prophets. It is for this reason that we encounter the voice of God supremely in the person of Jesus Christ. John says, no man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. The voice of God never bribes the self-life within us. Rather, its very quality commands our allegiance and creates a desire within us to follow him. Like the sound of a bell over a spring landscape, it has a clear tone that captures a spiritual perception. And the knowledge of this truth changes us so that we can never be the same again, whether we honor this knowledge with the love of our hearts and the devotion of our lives, or whether we trample it under our feet. And so it is symbolized by a two-edged sword, for it brings with it both mercy and judgment. It brings mercy to those who receive it gladly, but as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. To those who reject him, it brings judgment. And this is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. The vital task of education, the vital task of the church, is to help bring to pass that mysterious event whereby we suddenly stand still, discern the still small voice, and know that it is God. The essential authority of the Scriptures, the essential authority of the person of Jesus Christ, the essential authority of the fellowship of the saints lies in this. They each partake of the Spirit of God, and therefore may at any moment become transparent to the light of God. If we want to develop a scientist, we bring the aspirant into first-hand contact with science in the making. He best captures the secret spirit of science by participating in the scientific process, by exposure to the minds that are seeing and creating, rather than to pre-digested treatises about science. Even so, we bring the aspirant of the Christian experience into participation in the Christian life through worship, through the sacraments, through the fellowship of the saints, through the sharing in the struggle to relate the principles of our Christian experience to our daily living. There was a time when the young lad Samuel knew not the voice of the Lord. But there came a night when the Lord called, Samuel, Samuel. Samuel answered, speak, for thy servant heareth. It is my conviction that at the center of every creative life stands a divine call, and that the measure of a man's greatness is the totality of his response to that call. In this age of propaganda, it is necessary to distinguish between the great and the notorious, between the great and the famous. Greatness has nothing to do with publicity. It is the fruit of a profound relationship with a divine call. Greatness could be seen in the Yale professor Willard Gibbs, the founder of modern thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, and probably the greatest physicist that America has produced. One day the administration of Yale University decided that they needed to adorn their faculty with an outstanding theoretical physicist. So they made a pilgrimage to Cambridge, England, to find one. Whereupon the scholars at Cambridge pointed out to the administrators that they already had on their faculty Willard Gibbs, the leading theoretical physicist in the world at that time. Willard Gibbs. The embarrassed administrators had never heard of their own Willard Gibbs. I fear that our universities sometimes fail to communicate to the student the centrality of an inner call. Great scholars who have been awakened by some inner voice, whose lives are motivated by it and dedicated to it, are usually reluctant to share the fact of its existence, beckoning them ever onward, they know not whither. This is their private affair. They prefer to expose only their preoccupation with the essential tasks of obtaining information and of developing their analytical skills for the purpose of finding order and pattern within this information. Although facts and analysis are not the only aspects of scholarly judgment, they bow before that elusive shrine, the shrine of that elusive concept, objectivity, and they pretend that this is so. For it is the final formulation of an idea, not the tortuous route to its conception, which alone can be thrown out to their peers for judgment. In the natural sciences, we deal with the relationships between measurables. Something that can be measured can be assigned a number. And the relationships between numbers can be expressed in the language of mathematics. In this case alone, do we approximate objectivity? Do we strip scholarly judgment of everything but facts and analysis? Yet even here, it is the intuitive flight of the imagination which has the ability to see the essential relationship which is eventually written down. But when we leave the restricted realm of quantitative relationships between numbers to concern ourselves with relationships of quality, with relationships in ethics, in form, in beauty, we walk not only by the light of our intellect, but also by the light of our spiritual apprehension. Judgments of quality are made in terms of the illumination within us, an illumination that emanates from our relationship with the inner voices. It is no wonder Jesus warned us, "If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness?" I repeat, therefore, that the vital task of the church, the vital task of education, is not accomplished whenever opinions and solutions are given without first confronting the inquirer with the great problems or questions to which they are addressed. For the formulation of a problem may of itself be the avenue of a divine illumination. The ferment of intellectual and spiritual life comes from the probing questions that echo and re-echo down the corridors of our souls. If we isolate the student from the probing, disturbing questions, providing him instead the soothing comforts of predigested doctrines and opinions, we condemn him to a safe, dead orthodoxy. He conforms to the opinions of men, but he knows not the vital breath of God. Such a verbal orthodoxy is brittle. It is easily shattered by the skeptic's cynic's thrust. But the shield of faith is not so, for it is rooted and grounded in a love and a knowledge of love that cannot be assailed by reason. The battleground of faith is our whole person, will, intellect, and emotions. First, there is the battle of the will to put forth the effort to wait upon God, to struggle for understanding with both mind and spirit until illumination is given. Then there is the struggle to remain faithful to the illumination that is given. When the cost involves being misunderstood by our friends, even by our families, and the risk of a new way of life. If faith is born of a voice, it is created only as we commit ourselves, our souls and bodies, to that voice. That is why the quality of a man's life is the only mark of his relationship to the inner voices. And the fruit of our life is nourished by what we honor, by what we cherish. Therefore, victorious faith depends upon our response as well as upon the call. The vision, the call of God, is a precious gift that must be held sacred and inviolate if we are to maintain our essential integrity. Whatever else a man does, he must be true to this. To betray this gift is to do violence to our soul. Such a betrayal is, I believe, what Jesus referred to as the sin against the Holy Ghost. Every man, scholar, scientist, Christian, who follows his inner voice is led out into a lonely road. Though struggles and sufferings may attend his steps, so also creativity follows a faith that ventures into the unknown. Our faith is not a static stronghold of security. It is a dynamic force through which the grace of God transforms the world. Saul of Tarsus followed the leading of God's voice, even though it meant suffering and persecution. And God established the Church of Jesus Christ among the Gentiles. At the end of his life, Paul could sing, "I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith." Yet how often we are paralyzed, either through laziness or fear, into inaction. There are many who are drawn to Christ precisely because they discern within him the call of holiness. Yet they fail to follow. They fail to grow in knowledge because they are bound. Bound to a habit, to a relationship, to an ambition, to a pretense with which they cannot part. They stand at the threshold of salvation, but they will not let loose of their securities in this world. Therefore, they know not true freedom, freedom to serve that which they see to be holy, freedom to do their duty as their conscience dictates, without catering either to threats from outside or to fear within. Surely we have all stood on this threshold and cried out, as did Moses of old, "Who am I that I should go?" It is just here that the triumphal song of the saints should swell the heaven with their joyous testimony to the faithfulness of God's reply. "Certainly, I will be with thee." Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith.
Perhaps you will allow me, before I start, just to say a word of appreciation to Mr. Hardbutt and others for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity and privilege of meeting you all. You'll be glad to hear my luggage did come with me on this occasion. The only time I've ever lost my luggage anywhere in the world was at Chicago, but that was just to be expected, and I was in San Francisco and it was in Chicago. That was awkward. But thank you very much for inviting me, and I greatly appreciate the privilege of being here. One of the things I enjoy most, and I suppose ministers enjoy some things more than others, is the opportunity that we have a good deal of in England, and that is of, at least I do, of going to places where your audience can heckle you. You are too well behaved for my liking. American audiences are. Every address you give is wonderful. It isn't anything else, ever. It's very kind and gracious, but one doesn't quite accept that criticism always. But when you can be heckled, especially by communists and others, then you really enjoy preaching the gospel, at least I do. And the usual thing I get from somebody or other is, what does it really matter, all this religion and this doctrine and theology and all the stuff you parsons talk? All that really matters is to love your neighbor as yourself. Mind you, I'm always amused they think that's so easy. But they do seem to think so. They say that's after all what Jesus said. He said that was the most important thing. To which I reply, unfortunately, Jesus said the most important thing was to love God. That was the first commandment. But however, I do agree that the second commandment is important. Our Lord said, link them both together. And so tonight I want to talk with you for the 45 minutes. I'm just warning you that it was allotted to me. And I propose to take it, so you just know the truth. I want to warn you for the 45 minutes that's allotted to me. I want to talk with you about this second commandment, loving one's neighbor as oneself. You all know the story, I'm sure, of that bishop. He was Episcopalian, I feel certain, who was so heavenly minded. You see, no Methodist bishop ever would be that, so that was why I had to be Episcopalian. He was so heavenly minded that he was no earthly use. Well, God means us to have a religion that is some earthly use. After all, it's very important for Christian people, especially very Christian people, to realize that God has put them very firmly in this world. In fact, Jesus said, as my Father hath sent me, even so send I you, and God sent his Son into the world. We mustn't try and escape from our involvement. And many spiritual people try and escape from their worldly involvement. And this is just not being Christian. So I want to introduce my lecture to you with thinking for a moment about the attitude that Christians, different attitudes that Christians take up towards the world outside. I'm referring, of course, at this moment, to real, dedicated Christians, not just to the nominal churchgoer. The nominal churchgoer, as you know, Karl Barth described as a dangerous byproduct and a regrettable misunderstanding. A dangerous byproduct of real Christianity, because there would be no nominal churchgoers if there was no real Christianity, and a regrettable misunderstanding because everybody thinks they're real Christians when they're not. The type of person you will remember that Bill Carmen, your poet, sung about when he said, they're praising God on Sunday, they'll be all right on Monday, it's just a little habit they've acquired. Now, I'm not referring to this nominal church going. I'm referring now to the real, seriously minded, dedicated Christian. And you will notice, as you observe them, the dedicated Christians take up, as a rule, one of two positions towards the world outside in which they live. One position, quite briefly, is this. It's a good historical position. The world is lost. The world is doomed. Some of them go as far as believing that the world is, or part of the world, is predestined to be lost. The state is utterly corrupt. All political programs are as bad as each other. And their reaction is to withdraw from the world. Politics is a dirty game. All that really matters is to keep the remnant of Christians, of which of course they are one, elect and pure and holy, on the path for heaven. Now, this is an attitude that is adopted by Christians even today. We mustn't sneer at it, because some of you will remember that the Puritans and the Pilgrim Fathers held something very like this, and you have a lot to thank them for. They did indeed bear a genuine witness to the need to keep oneself unspotted from the world. There is some genuine truth in that attitude. Today, in England, and I expect in America, there are some modern conservative evangelical Christians who hold this point of view, and they don't really believe in evangelism. They oppose men like Dr. Billy Graham and any other evangelists. They don't believe there should be any appeal for people to come out and decide for Christ. They're just lost, or else they're in the elect, the remnant of the faithful. And such congregations build up their own spiritual life and let the world go to hell. There's a variation on this one, I'm glad to say, which doesn't quite let the world go to hell, but rushes round seeking to save individual souls like brands from the burning here and there, just a few people picked up. But the world as a whole, the mass of society, well, that's lost. And the only hope to put things right is the second coming. Now, one again must be careful, because such people shame other Christians by their drive, their zeal, their soul winning, their earnestness to help others to Christ. And we owe them a very great debt of gratitude. But one can't help but ask, when you read the New Testament, isn't this attitude, whatever its variation, isn't it a way of escape? Is it true that God's only concern is with individuals, a very few individuals, really, when you come to think of it, here and there, whose souls are very fortunately saved? Is this not an evasion of God's natural world? He, after all, is the Creator. And isn't God concerned with the whole of creation groaning and waiting for the day of redemption, as Paul puts it? And after all, is it possible really to look at life like this at all? Because after all, we are not really just souls. We are embodied persons. And one of the great teachings of the Bible, quite differently from the Greek teaching, is that I am an embodied person. The Bible knows nothing about a soul apart from a person, a body. We are embodied persons. That's why Jesus linked up healing of the body and feeding of the body with the spiritual life of the soul, because it's one complete person that I am in God's purpose. That's why, from one point of view, Christianity is a worldly religion. Jesus said some very striking things about money and government and obedience to government. And the epistles are very full of detailed, practical teaching about everyday life, not just about heaven. Anyhow, the incarnation took part on earth. And the incarnation wasn't simply, and let's be clear about this, it wasn't simply that God came down and was disguised as a man and walked about in Jesus, the kind of disguised God. The incarnation means that God did in very fact become part of the very human stuff of which we are human stuff. And he forever, therefore, dignified this worldly life of ours. The humanness of man is dignified by the incarnation of Christ. And so you see, we can't, I think, escape from the world, let it go to hell. The main society streaming away, just be concerned with a few individuals being saved. Which brings me to the next attitude, which seems to me more biblical. And that is to see that God's concern is with the redemption of the whole world of society. Man's whole life of personal relationships, not just with an individual here and there. Remember how Jesus taught when he said that Christians were to be like leaven, leavening the whole lump of dough. And you can't leaven dough unless the leaven's mixed right up with the dough. Inextricably part of it. If you get a lump of yeast, it's most unpleasant. It's got all to be well mixed if the lump is to be truly leavened. There you have the clear teaching of Jesus. His command to his people is to be well mixed up and involved in human society if they're to fulfill their task of leavening the lump. Of course, that will involve changing individuals. It will involve changing society. And I quite agree. The New Testament is perfectly clear that the ultimate climax of it all will be the second coming of Christ, whatever that means. But at the end of our leavening the lump, we shall not in the end create the utopia, even one pleasing to God. It will be some act of God at the climax of the whole process for his final triumph. After all, what triumph is there to God if at the end this society of ours is simply doomed? Where is his victory? Where is the victory won in the resurrection here on earth over sin and death? If this is not going to happen, this final triumph of God here on earth where sin has occurred. I don't know whether you've read that interesting book, which you should have read, by Willie Gallagher, who was the only Communist Party member we've ever had in Parliament. Very proud we've had one, because, of course, you wouldn't even allow one to get into Congress here, and I think that's an advantage of liberty to have one in Parliament. And you should read Willie Gallagher's book called The Case for Communism. It reads very like the New Testament. He's full of an absolute confident hope, as every real communist is. He believes and makes it vivid and living and dynamic that in the end, ultimately, nothing can stop it. The ultimate collective socialist society will be here. Nothing can stop it. Why does he believe that? He believes it, as you know, because he thinks the whole movement of the evolutionary process is moving inevitably to that end. So you can't stop it. We can't stop it. Nobody can stop it happening. Now, that's the first thing I want to make. The same kind of confidence as in the New Testament he has got. And therefore, you see, as a true communist, his one business in life is to toe the party line. In other words, to do anything that will help forward the movement of history. He doesn't mind whether he dies or lives. He can't care less whether he sees it happen or not. Because happen it will. His business is to contribute to the movement of history to that final goal. Men and women, this is exactly like the New Testament in reverse. The New Testament sees that God's triumph for redeeming this society of ours is as certain as the coming dawn. Because this is God's intention, God's redemptive purpose for history. And the Christian's business is not to ask, will I see it happen in my lifetime? The Christian's business is to say, this is God's will. Whether I live or die doesn't matter. My business is to offer myself in contribution towards the ultimate triumphant purpose of God. There's the great dynamic of the New Testament, which we seem to have lost. This is no creating a man-made utopia at all. It's living and behaving in absolute faith and hope that God's purpose cannot be frustrated by man. And my business is to contribute anything small insight I am granted by him into his purpose. Now, if you agree so far with this attitude of the real Christian towards the world, as I've said to you plainly to start with, some of you may not agree. I pointed out there were Christians who didn't. But if you do agree with this attitude of the Christian towards his world in which he's involved, then we are in the position to discuss what I started with. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Now you see we can begin to ask a question properly. What does it mean to love my neighbor as once myself if this is what I think about my attitude to the world as a Christian? I can ask first of all, of course, who and what is my neighbor? What is God's intention for my neighbor? Well, neighbor doesn't require much analysis. A neighbor is anybody who's nigh to me, neighbor, nigh to me. A neighbor is, in other words, any other person with whom I am in contact, with whom I am involved. That's quite clear. So we know what neighbor means. But what does it mean to love my neighbor? Well, I've got to ask something further then, because love obviously means giving myself to my neighbor for my neighbor's ultimate good, that he may find his full life. Now, what is the full life for men and women? What is God's purpose and intention for them? Now, as soon as I give you my next 3 points, I can almost hear some of you say, but really this fellow is talking a lot of platitudes. This is all part and parcel of the American way of life. Well, I'm not so sure about that, but theoretically it is. You say, well, all this is written in the Bill of Human Rights and all the rest of it. I'm quite prepared to agree with you. But you see, what people will not understand is that these ideas I propose to give you in a moment come historically from Jesus Christ. The thing I constantly have to do in your universities and in England, but very much so over here, if I may be quite honest with you, because so many of your students seem to me to have little historical sense, is to make them understand that this is historically true. That is an objective fact in history. These new ideas of Jesus were new. We've got so used to them now that we divorce them from their source. We're living on borrowed capital and are not honest enough or knowledgeable enough to acknowledge our debt. In fact, one of the books for required reading in Stanford University, and I think many other of your universities, is a certain book on Western civilization. It's for first-year students. And many of my friends tell me that this book is utterly unfair because it leaves out the influence of Christianity on our Western civilization. In other words, it's a bogus history. Some of your students are being foisted on them bogus history. We complain about the communists twisting history. This twisting of history happens in democracies too. And as a Christian, I hope you are with me opposed to the falsification of historic truth. Because here it's a very serious matter. Jesus Christ did in fact bring certain new ideas into the world. And history cannot be as if Christ had never been. You cannot take Jesus Christ and his influence out of our culture. And the very interesting thing is that so very rarely do you hear Christian people in argument with non-Christians make this point and make it securely, that the influence of Christ is deep and real in spite of all the failures of the Christian church. Now let me just take the three things I want to bring to your notice. What kind of value did Jesus Christ give to human personality? What were the kind of values Christ was working for individual persons to have, and society as a whole to have? There are three, and there were new emphases in his day, though Greek culture, to some extent, supported him in one of them at least. First, Jesus took the line that a man could not be man as God meant him to be unless he was a free person, able to choose the ends for his life and able to some measure to direct his actions within certain limits. Because obviously, if God has meant us to be free choosing people, and we're a group of free choosing people, we are limited to some extent by the other free choosing people. You can't shoot your rubbish into my backyard. It's my backyard. We are limited to some extent. We're limited, as now modern psychology is showing us, to some extent by the hangover of the past. It's my father's fault, mostly, when I go wrong these days, I think. I'm not quite up to date in the latest psychology, but something like that. And so it's a bit to do with father, or else it's got something to do with glands. I think if you fall in love with somebody, you can't really help it. You didn't choose it. It was all glands, but something of that sort. And of course, to some extent, there's truth here, and some Christians are terrified of psychology and frightened to death of these new brain operations because it seems to destroy all the basic.